Well, the applause after just the first movement was generous enough, but listen to it now. Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto, performed at the Proms tonight by Joshua Bell with the National Youth Orchestra of the United States of America, conducted by Valery Gergiev. And don't forget that it's only 3 weeks or so since they all met up for the very first time to begin their schedule with an intensive 2-week residency. And my goodness, they've come a long way since then. Not least geographically, because they've been giving concerts in America and then Russia as well. A very intense experience, I'm told, for them to perform that Tchaikovsky in Russia. They take their Tchaikovsky very seriously there. And the players, well, applauding each other as well they might. And Joshua Bell coming back on stage with Valery Gergiev. 23 years since Joshua Bell first appeared here at the Proms, and it's always a pleasure to come back, he says. And he added a bonus this year that he's working with these young players and with Valery Gergiev. Now, the two of them have never worked together before this tour, although Joshua Bell had always particularly wanted to play the Tchaikovsky with Gergiev. So that's an ambition achieved tonight. And when he was talking to me earlier, he was so complimentary about these young players. He said he feels that aspiring to join this new orchestra should be like going to the Olympics for the young people. They're the heroes, he said, and they're aiming to be a part of something very special. It's really something for them to strive for. And here he is back on stage now with Valery Gergiev. So the huge acclaim of the crowd here at the Royal Albert Hall. Valery Gergiev bringing the young players to their feet again. And Joshua Bell bowing low. Thank you. A Tchaikovsky encore to follow the violin concerto, the melody, the third movement of the Souvenir d'un lieu cher, in an arrangement by Alexandru Lascai, performed so gracefully by Joshua Bell and the National Youth Orchestra of the USA, conducted by Valery Gergiev. And Joshua Bell said he's looking forward in the next 20 or 30 years to meeting these young players as they go through their careers. And he said he hopes that they'll come up to him and say, I remember you. We played the Tchaikovsky together when I was 15. And here he is back on stage now with Valery Gergiev. Fascinating to watch them both rehearsing with the orchestra, taking such immense time and trouble and great pains to fine-tune their performances and pass on their knowledge and wisdom. Valery Gergiev, of course, supreme in Russian repertoire. The process these young players had to get into the orchestra was quite a rigorous one. They had to submit an essay, a speech, and of course an audition tape, some of them auditioning online, in fact. The judging panel then selected the final 120, and here they are tonight. Well, they'll return in part two to play another Russian work, Shostakovich's 10th Symphony. But before that, our Proms Plus intro, which took place earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music, just over the road from the Royal Albert Hall. It's introduced by Ian Skelly.
Yes, I have two guests on stage here tonight. In a little while, I'll be talking to Gerard McBurney, composer, writer, broadcaster, and an expert on Russian music. So I'm going to tap into his enormous enthusiasm for the great crescendo of a work that's going to bring tonight's prom to a close, the 10th Symphony by Shostakovich. The symphony Khachaturian called An Optimistic Tragedy. But first, someone who isn't really much older than some of the members of tonight's brand new orchestra here at the Proms, Sean Shepherd, who was commissioned to write the very first piece that the National Youth Orchestra of the United States was going to play in its first ever concert just a couple of weeks ago, when they launched their tour that's taken them from the USA to St. Petersburg and Moscow, and finally here to the Proms. Sean is here at the Proms to hear that piece given its UK premiere and, as far as I know, the world premiere broadcast here on BBC Radio 3. Would you please welcome them both? Well, Sean, welcome to the Proms, first of all.
Oh, thank you very much. Wonderful to be here.
How was the tour so far?
It's been so exciting. It's been really exhausting in a certain way. This orchestra is brand new, lots of bright young faces, and the ages of the musicians themselves is 16 to 19. And it's only been a few years since I've been that age, but I forget how much they eat and how little sleep they need. So it's been a terrifically taxing few weeks for me.
I suppose it's quite useful with all the clock changes to not have to sleep at all.
Yeah.
But I presume quite a few members of the orchestra have never been out of the US before, so what did they make of Russia?
There were many new passport applications, and it was a very exciting time getting through all the passport control with visas and a lot of new experiences for everybody. But it's the tour itself has been spectacular. It was actually my first time in the Russian Federation as well. An amazing country, and it, in a way, it feels and it looks so much like other European countries or the States. And then we have this language in Cyrillic, and I worked very, very hard on my five Russian words, which then I could not say couldn't say in performance. But it's been a terrific tour, and ending, I think the thrust of our tour has always been toward this fantastic and a very exciting audience of the BBC Proms. So.
Well, yes, I mean, we talk a lot about it here, but it must be quite an extraordinary experience for an orchestra like this to sit in front of this audience.
Well, in the first
week... Do they know what they're expecting?
Well, they've been coached. I was one of them saying, this is very exciting. The orchestra's very excited themselves, but I'm not sure they really knew at the beginning, what a warm reception they're going to get at the Proms and what that experience is like. I've been trying to compare it to somewhere between a classical concert and a rock concert, but in a really great way. So,
well, we'll come back to the orchestra in just a moment, but let's just talk about the piece here at the Proms tonight. The very first piece that the orchestra ever played, and you took as your inspiration, really, your trip to Russia. What does the title mean?
Magia is it's a Russian word. It simply just means magic. I knew that the sort of construct of the tour was going to have the great Russian maestro Valery Gergiev. I knew we were going to be touring to Russia, and I knew that the program would include these, you know, the pillars, two of the main pillars of the entire repertoire, the great 10th Symphony of Shostakovich, which is one of my personal favorites, and the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto. So I knew that there would be this kind of, you know, borscht-flavored program. And it also appealed to me very much to honor a tradition which I have always felt close to since my very, since I was about these students' age, you know, just the fantastic tradition of the Russian overture, you know, from Ruslan and Ludmila through to, you know, all the way to, you know, Shostakovich's festive overture. So I thought about those, you know, those kind of parameters, but then I also, I think there are a few composers in the world who haven't taken something in terms of orchestration and thinking about how the orchestra works. From the Russians, from someone like, you know, Rimsky-Korsakov, all the way through Stravinsky, through to, you know, even Schnitka, modern masters.
Did you take particular themes from Russian folk tunes?
I tried not to, and it's been pointed out to me that one might hear a little bit more American influence than I ever intend. I've heard a few people coming up and saying, I think I hear some Copland in there, so. Which is never far from home either. So
yes.
there's somehow
the
stars and stripes are always flying.
Yeah. And the horns of New York, possibly. Let's just talk about the orchestra. It is, as you say, a brand new orchestra, which I suppose up to a point you can always say about a youth orchestra, but this is absolutely brand new. Just give us a bit of background to what caused it to be created.
Yeah, I think, well, you know, there is this greater youth orchestra movement in the world, or there as many have pointed out, there is a very, very good youth orchestra in this country, which I've long admired. And so being part of a movement, a really, truly national movement, there are students and musicians from 42 of the 50 American states, states like Wyoming and Montana, people who are extremely talented, and probably very often in a place where they yearn to be with other musicians of such a high caliber, such high craft, and so watching them come together and making their very specific kind of magic has been really, very truly inspiring to me, someone a few years out, and I venture to say that it's been inspiring for someone like Maestro Gergiev, who has taken to them in a really very warm-hearted way.
But it's quite intense, isn't it? Because, I mean, the Youth Orchestra of Great Britain does meet over the course of a year, but am I right in thinking this is the result of 2 or 3 weeks intensive
work? Yes, so this is an intense short period. And so they met for about 10 days. We met at Purchase College in the United States in a few 30 miles north of New York. And so everyone gathered there, and the orchestra came together very quickly, I understand. And then we had things like workshops, and I talked with young composers, and we had conversations about improvisation and in yoga and all kinds of things. And there were terrific faculty mentors from the Chicago Symphony and the Los Angeles Philharmonic coming in and working with each section. And then preparing toward Maestro's arrival, there were 3 very intense days of rehearsal.
And so writing for an orchestra, which is a youth orchestra, you knew they weren't going to be to know each other before they came along. Did you have to sort of be careful about how you constructed your piece so that you tailored it to a young orchestra?
Well, I feel like, one of my, I don't know if I could say mantras as a composer, is I always feel that it's my job to think about the megaphone through which I'm going to send this message. And so I knew I wanted an exuberant piece, and I knew I wanted to make a celebration of kinds. I mean, this orchestra, to me, is very much worth celebrating. And I knew that ahead of time. And I felt a certain sense of pressure about knowing that these would definitely be the first notes this orchestra played. And so that was, it's a special honor, I would say. Thinking in terms of technical abilities, I think that's something that I think probably looking back, I did it in an intuitive way, that maybe we can cut down the septuplets in these kinds of very specifically difficult ideas and concepts, but I never in any way felt limited by what I was doing. I knew that it would be excellently performed, which is...
So you've pushed them as a composer?
I think that's something one can say about me with every single piece and every single orchestra, yes.
And does this give you a degree of hope for the future of orchestras in the United States of America when you see this group performing together?
After I saw the first rehearsal, actually, of my piece, I turned to someone and I said, the future looks very bright.
Really?
It's very exciting. And it's, I think, well, and I think you can see it in Europe and in Asia, there's so much spectacular talent. It gives me a lot of hope for the future of orchestras and for the future of music.
Sean, thank you very much indeed. My second guest in this Proms Plus event here at the Royal College of Music is Gerard McBurney, a composer himself, as I say, as well as a writer and broadcaster, and a well-known great passion for Russian music and culture. So he's just the person to talk about Shostakovich's music, and in particular, the Tenth Symphony, which was composed in the wake of Stalin's death in 1953. Gerard has not quite brought a piano with him to demonstrate the structure of this piece, but we have a piano on stage, so we'll hear him playing in a little while. Gerard, as with really all of Shostakovich's music, you do have to bear in mind the context in which he was writing. Stalin's death, 1953, absolutely pivotal moment, not just in his life, but in the life of Russia at the time. Can you give us a bit of a run-up to that period? What had it been like for Shostakovich before 53?
Well, it's true that the context is very, very important. And in the case of this particular piece, of course it's true that the death of Stalin was the most tremendous historical watershed which affected our lives in the West, as well as, of course, every single citizen of the Soviet Union at that time. But Shostakovich himself had, as many people will remember, he had been subjected to a great deal of control and pressure, and indeed public humiliation in the course of his life. And the most recent episode of that had been the famous Congress of 1948, in which he and Sergei Prokofiev and a number of other well-known composers were forced to apologize for their supposed errors and to promise in front of the nation that they would write music in a different way. They weren't the only ones. The composers were not the only ones. The same thing happened to writers, filmmakers, scientists, all kinds of people. The composers were simply a way station in this process of intimidating educated people. But for Shostakovich, it had been especially hard.
But he did sort of stop him publicly writing the music he wanted to write, really. I mean, the score itself says that he wrote this in two bursts of activity, August and October 53. Is it possible, though, that he'd been preparing for this before that moment?
Anything is possible with this particular composer, who tended to tell different stories to different people at different points. It is perfectly possible. There is also the fact that Shostakovich tended to have goes at pieces which he would then abandon. For instance, the previous symphony, which was intended to be a public celebration of the end of World War II in 1945, he had several goes, one of which has now reappeared and indeed been recorded. And interestingly, some of the musical material in the aborted Symphony No. 9 turns up in the first movement of Symphony No. 10. He evidently abandoned that symphony, but an idea or two must have remained in his head. I wouldn't want to overstress the connection, but it certainly sounds very similar to what we hear.
So you would accept that really he sat down one day and just started to write the symphony in 53?
It's my experience of Shostakovich that he tended to write very, very fast. He tended to write, he was a composer, as indeed was his colleague Prokofiev, and his friend Benjamin Britten, who wrote in the moment. He wasn't somebody like Stravinsky, for example, who would program a piece, plot his approach to a piece very, very carefully. He was a much more instinctive artist than that. He wrote on the moment. If you look at his archive, which I visited many times, you find many abandoned pieces, and I'm sure it's perfectly possible that an earlier version of the Tenth might turn up there. It's not all been explored, but my guess would be that what we have as the Tenth is something that he wrote, boom, in the summer and autumn of that year. That was the way he tended to work.
And the great thing about Shostakovich is, uncoding the codes, really. I mean, This is obviously a reflection of a degree of relief, and also what has happened up to that time of Stalin's death. Very powerful expression of the struggle that so many people went through during those years. Can you decode the structure of the symphony for us? Briefly speaking,
there are a number of things to be said about this great symphony. The first is that it has, and Sean Shepherd was alluding to that earlier in the Russian art and music he was talking about, it has a carnivalesque quality to it, a very, very brilliant quality, especially in the extremely macabre second movement, which is a sort of dance of death, and in the fourth movement, which you yourself earlier described as a crescendo. It's the most brilliant, and I would go further and say vicious, way to end a symphony. It takes the roof off, but it leaves a very, very strange sensation in the ears of the listeners. And I would like to say that that is not uncharacteristic of Soviet art at the period. If you look at what the poets were writing in 1953, if you look at the films that were being made in 1953, there was a strange quality in the wake of Stalin's death, as though something was stirring. There is definitely a carnivalesque quality to that this symphony. Within that, however, there's something else rather strange, which is it's well known that Shostakovich in his music liked to reflect Jewish ideas, Jewish themes, mostly klezmer themes. And klezmer starts appearing in the 1940s, especially in his string quartets and in the first violin concerto, which was written 3 or 4 years before this symphony, and which has a lot in common with it. Towards the beginning, the opening movement begins very mysteriously, but then a clarinet comes in with a tune that definitely sounds like one of those klezmer lullabies that are so beautiful and that are, if you like, the quieter side of the great klezmer tradition. And then the last movement is once, again, he begins with a slow introduction, but once he gets going, it launches into what is nothing more or less than a Freilachs, which is the dance. Even if you don't know anything about klezmer, you will have probably seen Fiddler on the Roof or heard tunes from it, which Fiddler is full of Freilachs. It's the most joyful, as you can tell from the Yiddish word Freilachs, which is clearly related to the German word for joy. It's a dance of joy, though very often it's a modal dance or it's in a minor key, but it's the dance that's most familiar at the end of Jewish weddings. And the last movement of this symphony is, in the body of it, a wild Freilachs, a dance of joy.
And what of the famous letters in the symphony? There are two sets of initials, aren't there?
Well, Shostakovich became well known within his lifetime for signing off his works by including his initials in a mixture of German and solfège notation. These are the notes DSCH, S in German notation, C, and then H. And that is, he includes that idea in many different pieces. This symphony ends with this phrase, this tiny four note. You could really call it a meme, I guess, in modern computer speak, which just goes round and round and round, particularly brilliantly on the four timps in the closing bars of this piece. But it wasn't known until relatively recently, I guess about 10 years ago, that there's another name encoded in this symphony. The slow movement of this symphony has a rather strange structure. It has a rather beautiful, old-fashioned sounding, almost Glinka-esque melody in the beginning of the slow movement. But then the music is interrupted by a horn call, rather distinctive horn call, which never changes. And that horn call happens 12 times in the course of the movement. It brings the romantic music, if you like, to a halt. And it was only discovered, as I say, about a decade or maybe a little more ago, that in fact this was the name of someone. Indeed, more than that, it was the name of one of Shostakovich's students, a young woman, a composer, Elmira Nazirova, who's a Jewish composer from Azerbaijan, from the city of Baku, who was studying as a postgraduate student with Shostakovich at that time. And she was very alarmed when she went back for her summer vacation with her family. She started receiving very passionate letters from the married composer, who told her that he was encoding her name into his new symphony. E. La. Mi. Re. So in fact, in this slow movement, he is calling to her 12 times. In the course of the time that he was writing this music, he actually asked Elmira to send him a photograph of herself so that he could keep it on his piano while he was on his desk while he was working. But she never revealed this story until long, long, many years later, when after she'd emigrated to Israel, where she told a young Israeli musicologist this story, and indeed showed the young musicologist the letters that Shostakovich had written to her. And one of them, and this is, tells you something about the playful nature of Shostakovich's mind, in one of them he said, you know, this horn call means so much to me because it means not only you, it's also the beginning of one of my favorite pieces of music in the whole repertoire. The beginning, of course, of Das Lied von der Erde.
Which he was listening to at the time.
Which he was listening to at the time. Well, he had no need to listen to it, although he did because he knew it by heart.
Yes.
He then goes on, rather startlingly, in the letter to say, actually, when I was writing this horn call in my symphony, I was thinking not just of the beginning of Das Lied von der Erde, but of the bit halfway through the first movement, the Trinklied, when the poet, the Chinese poet, sees an ape howling over a tomb. So we may make of that information whatever we choose to make of it. I'm not sure it leaves us much the wiser, but it certainly is provocative about the way that composers' imaginations work.
What an image to end with. Gerard McBurney and Sean Shepherd, thank you both very much.
Ian Skelly introduced that Brahms Plus intro earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music. And the next Brahms Plus intro is tomorrow night. It's before the start of this year's epic Brahms Ring Cycle, conducted by Daniel Barenboim. Sarah Moore-Peach will be giving an introduction to Das Weingold with guest Barbara Eichner. Well, welcome back now to the Royal Albert Hall with me, Penny Gore, live on BBC Radio 3 and online. We're about to rejoin the National Youth Orchestra of the United States of America as it makes its first visit to the Proms in its inaugural season. I can report that there's great excitement backstage after the first half, with a long queue of players eager to collect pictures and autographs from Joshua Bell. Well, after this morning's rehearsal, I went outside into the sunshine to talk to two of those orchestra members, 17-year-olds Lily Tsai and Gabe Young. And I asked them how they'd been able to bond as an orchestra in their 3 weeks together.
The residency was a big help because anytime you have people living together and under the same roof, it really encourages bonding. And a great part of musical bonding is relationship bonding. And so the orchestra has developed quite a good family feel.
And we haven't seen it yet, it'll be revealed tonight, but you have a specially designed concert costume, which is really unusual.
Both girls and guys wear a suit jacket with a white shirt underneath, and then I think the most striking feature of our costume is our bright red pants, and we're also wearing Converse sneakers, which have stars on them to show off our U.S. pride.
And tell me about working with Valery Gergiev.
I can only speak for myself, but I've never worked with a conductor quite like Maestro Gergiev. He's very unique, not only in the way he conducts, but the way he rehearses. His knowledge of music is unequaled. He's really a true legend of classical music, and it's just such an incredible experience to be able to work with him.
Oboist Gabe Young and violinist Lily Sy talking to me earlier. And Lily is the leader or concertmaster of the orchestra for this second half of the concert. She's just rejoined her colleagues on stage. They're tuning ready for their performance of Shostakovich's 10th Symphony. Well, the work was finished exactly 50 years ago in the fateful year of 1953. As Gerard McBurney was explaining, Stalin died that March, as did Prokofiev, eerily enough, on the very same day. And for Shostakovich, the demise of the dictator unlocked a torrent of musical creativity. He hadn't written a new symphony for 8 years, and the 10th is quite clearly full of a mass of personal allusions and emotions, not always easy to work out with Shostakovich, but including his own musical motto, as we heard, the notes for his initials, DSCH, as well as Elmira, the name of that composition pupil and close confidant, Elmira Nazimova. The truth about those notes not finally revealed until the 1990s, unlocking the secret at last of Shostakovich's unrequited love. And applause as the players rise to their feet for the entry of Valery Gergiev, rejoining the National Youth Orchestra of the United States of America for this Proms performance of Shostakovich's Symphony No. 10.
Thank you. Thank you.
Symphony No. 10 by Shostakovich, first performed at the Proms only 2 years after it was written in 1955. Entwining its composer's motto with the name of his beloved Elmira Nazirova in a piece of rather wishful symbolism. Well, tonight it's the mighty conclusion to this prom and to the inaugural tour of the National Youth Orchestra of the United States of America, conducted by Valery Gergiev. Back on stage now. And, well, you can hear for yourself the acclaim. Now, that's for the horn player who played Elmira's theme. Valery Gergiev now making his way around the orchestra. Oboes, bassoons, flutes. The whole of the woodwind section now. And these young players all applauding their colleagues. Each section standing up one by one, that's the horns. The brass at the back, not too sure whether they ought to stand up, but yes, Valery Gergiev is very insistent. And the percussion section, an awful lot for them to do in this prom. And magnificently they rose to that challenge. Lily Tsai, the concertmaster, and now the whole of the strings. The entire orchestra on its feet. Well, after tonight, the players have a day to enjoy a bit of sightseeing around London and possibly have a bit of a rest, although I'm not sure how much rest they will get. Then the ensemble disbands to form again next year, largely with a new intake of players, though this year's members are permitted to reapply and re-audition if they still meet the criteria. And Valery Gergiev back on stage, asking them to take another bow. David Robertson will be the conductor next year and the coast-to-coast US tour is already planned.
We'll be right back.
Well, it really had to be, didn't it? An all-American encore. Porgy and Bess, a symphonic picture. Gershwin arranged by Robert Russell Bennett. And including a part for banjo, which until the players passed around when they took time out from their hard work at their two-week residency at Purchase College to enjoy a 4th of July barbecue. And the player tonight, hugely enjoying himself, by the way, donned a suitable hat, specially for his solo. And I'm told that is the orchestra's farewell gift to Maestro Gergiev. The young players of the National Youth Orchestra of the United States of America playing their hearts out tonight, ending their inaugural tour. And Valery Gergiev back on stage with them. I was going to say for a final bow, but I don't think it will be a final bow. This is going to go on for quite some time. Well, tonight made Proms history. There's more tomorrow at the Royal Albert Hall when the Berlin Staatskapelle and Daniel Barenboim, with a cast drawn from recent performances in Berlin and Milan, will begin the first ever complete ring cycle within a single Proms season with Wagner's Das Rheingold. That's live here on Radio 3 tomorrow from 7, preceded by the Proms Plus intro at 6:40. But for now, well, the adrenaline is almost tangible here at the Royal Albert Hall, and that's going to carry on for a while. A lot of stamping and cheering, but we must take our leave. I'll hand you back to Katrina Young at Broadcasting House.
Thank you, Penny. That was Penny Gore. And as usual, there'll be another chance to hear that prom during this coming week in Afternoon on 3. You can catch up with this one on Thursday, beginning at 2 o'clock. There is, of course, also the option of the Listen Again facility for any prom you might have missed. The Saturday matinee concerts began yesterday. They're coming live from Cadogan Hall in London, and the first one celebrated Handel's visit to Rome, with music performed by the Academy of Ancient Music under Richard Egar and featuring the soprano Sophie Bevan. So if you didn't catch that, it's not too late. It's available via the Radio 3 website or the BBC iPlayer radio app, and it'll stay there for the next 7 days. Well, as the National Youth Orchestra of the USA finished their prom with Gershwin, I thought I'd continue the theme, but with very much reduced forces, just one instrument, in fact, the piano. Eugenie Russo plays transcriptions by Gershwin from his own songbook. Eugenie Rosso with My One and Only from the Gershwin Songbook, and before it, I Got Rhythm.
Original British drama on BBC Four.
Starring Miss Elizabeth Taylor and Mr. Richard Burton.
In 1983, Hollywood's most famous couple appeared on stage together.
We did it. Standing ovation, 5-6 curtain calls.
They didn't think they were watching a play. They thought they'd had an invite into our lives.
But it was offstage where the real drama unfolded.
I know she can act. I know better than anyone.
Don't you dare think that you can tell me how to play my role.
Starring Dominic West and Helena Bonham Carter, Burton and Taylor, Monday night at 9 on BBC Four.
You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's just gone 10 o'clock and it's time now for a roundup of great new music from around the world with Lucy Duran.
Welcome to World Roots, and today I'm joined by writers John L. Walters and Arwa Haidar, who are here to sift through some great new music releases from around the world. Shortly, we'll be hearing field recordings from Coast Province, Kenya, Cypriot folk music with a modern twist, vintage gypsy pop from Tito's Yugoslavia, as well as the intriguing Frisian fado. But we'll start today with a track from our band In Session. Ever since they formed in the mid-1970s, they've worked tirelessly to preserve and promote the Cuban son tradition, that infectious mix of Spanish and African musical styles that was a soundtrack to 1920s Havana and beyond. So, here in the World Roots studio, with Chilandron de Chivo from Havana, Cuba, this is Sierra Maestra.
Mataron al chivo y se lo comieron. Mataron al chivo y se lo comieron. Ay, qué chivo tan sabroso el que se comió Miguel. Ay, qué chivo tan sabroso. El
Nine-piece Cuban son band Sierra Maestra with Chilandron de Chivo, recorded specially for World Roots in our Maida Vale studio, and we've more music from them later on in the programme. But first, joining me for our monthly roundup of new releases are John L. Walters and Arwa Haidar. So hello to both of you.
Hi, Lucy.
Arwa, we're starting with a new recording on Honest John's label. And what is it?
It's Mukunguni, which is a collection of field recordings, modern field recordings, of the Mijikenda people around the coastal province in Kenya. And it's a collection that's quite raw and unembellished at first when you listen to it, but it also, the more you listen to it, the more unusual twists there are in there. There are deep-rooted traditions, the notion that music can heal, percussive rhythms. But the track we're going to listen to is called Matatizo, or Worries. It was apparently recorded at a bus stop, and within the a cappella harmonies, if you listen, you'll also hear some references to very modern technology.
Haya mapenzi, uko kupenda, tulilete wa mwazangu danda wena maulana. Haya mapenzi, uko kupenda, tulilete wa mwazangu danda wena maulana. Ni malaika sejui, ni binadamu sielewi, kwa kompyuta na darubini sielewi, mwangu moyoni.
Haya mapenzi, kuku kupenda, tulelete wa zamani, dada we na maulana. Ni malaika sijui, ni binadamu sielewi, kwa kompyuta na darubini sielewi, mambo moyoni kuna mengine yani umiza.
Haya mapenzi, uko kupenda, tulilete wa mwenzangu dada we na maulana. Haya mapenzi, uko kupenda, tulilete wa mwenzangu dada we na maulana. Ni malaika sijui, ni binadamu sielewi, kwa kompyuta na darubini sielewi, mwangu moyoni mambo mengine yani umiza.
Haya mapenzi, uko kupenda, tulilete wa zamani dada we na maulana. Haya mapenzi, kuku kupenda, tulilete wa zamani dada we na maulana. Ni malaika sijui, ni binadamu sielewi, makompyuta na darubini sielewi, mambo mengine kuna mengine yani umiza.
Matatizo, meaning worries, a Swahili love song recorded at a bus stop, from the album Mukunguni, new recordings from Coast Province, Kenya, that's out on Honest John's.
When I started listening to this, I wasn't sure whether there'd be a coolness and detachment that would mean, you know, it felt analytical and wasn't...
Ethnographic rather
yeah,
than...
Yeah, which I, you know, which obviously isn't an easy, like, seems like an outmoded way of listening to music in some ways. And they strike the balance well with this, and they strike it in ways that you don't necessarily expect. Something that I was quite intrigued by on the credits for this album, as you mentioned, it's on Honest John's, and the people that recorded it are actually a pair of German experimental musicians, Stefan Schneider and Sven Kaczurek, who has previously worked with Kenyan musicians. So there's a real depth of interest and enthusiasm here that means it's not a coolly analytical project. There are very deep-rooted traditions, but I think the touches like the bus stop and the spontaneity of that kind of recording mean it feels like a living
thing. A lot of the music on the album is music for healing.
Yes.
Which is not the sort of music that you would likely hear produced in a studio. So there are the thing about field recordings is that there are many kinds of music that people wouldn't necessarily want to listen to or have the opportunity to listen to that
become accessible.
It's certainly not a conventional album, and it's not even a conventional Honest John's album, because we know this label from doing some very nicely curated compilations like London Is a Place for Me and folk music collections and Moondog recordings. So this is quite a different route. And when Awa mentioned the involvement of the producers, the guy from Two Rococo Rot,
Stephen Schneider's from that band,
I realised maybe there is a bit of an agenda here, that they're looking for some of the stranger noises, some of the more electronic sounding noises that appeal to their ears, their sense of what makes a contemporary recording. And I guess any person doing a field recording, however sort of conscientious they are, there's still going to be a musical animus working in the selection that we actually get onto the length of a CD.
The disparity of these tracks is really interesting. Some of them are, you know, tracks for exorcisms, and some of them are tracks for parties. And it's not a conventional album in that sense, but it works as a collection. I don't know, with some of the more raw percussive tracks, whether taken out of context, it would be an easy way to introduce it to someone.
You sort of have to admire Honest John's for putting out field recordings, because you know it's not going to sell thousands and thousands of copies. And you know, I really think that we need more albums that are like this, that are just field recordings. We were talking about the album Mukunguni, new recordings from Coast Province, Kenya, released by Honest John's. Moving to a very different part of the world, Cyprus. In fact, curiously enough, a country whose music isn't all that well known, or not that much represented outside the country itself. So what have you brought from Cyprus, John?
This is a trio with their debut album called Grippy Grappa. They're called Monsieur Dumani, stringed instruments and wind instruments, and this is a traditional song called Woman from Telluria.
Στους 7 πλανήτες για λουρούδα μου Έχει έναν άστρον και μητσίν Μες στους 7 πλανήτες για λουρούδα μου Πιάσανε μες στην καρκιά τα λόγια που μου είπες μαύρο μάτα μου και πιάσανε μες στην καρκιά τα λόγια που μου είπες μαύρο μάτα μου σήκωσε ένα αέρα για βρωμάτα μου.
Woman from Tilaria by the Cypriot group Monsieur Doumani from their album Gripi Grappa, which is out on their own label. Don't expect any sleeve notes because you won't find any. And all the titles are first written in Greek and then there's an English translation. So, John, why did you choose that particular track?
It's actually very catchy. The song is full of quite catchy Mediterranean melodies. Nothing that I knew or recognised, but I just felt there was something quite fun. You can see that they're a very popular live band. There is a kind of humorous element to what they do, but I don't think it's a disrespectful thing. I think they use that humour as well to do quite satirical songs, things that comment on the current political situation there.
Arwa, what do you think?
I mean, you were sort of saying, you know, it's very easy on the ears, very deftly played Mediterranean-sounding melody, and I would be really interested to hear more Cypriot roots. And I think some of the traditional melodies that they've chosen to cover on this album actually are traditions that span from Anatolia to Greece. They're not necessarily specifically from one part of Cyprus. That's not necessarily made completely clear, but it makes it a bit generic.
Also, you know, the fact they come from very different musical backgrounds. So, you know, they might have started off playing electronic instruments or classical instruments or rock guitar, and they've somehow channeled a kind of rocky, poppy, almost proggy sensibility into playing acoustic instrument.
And I think you can hear that a bit in the flute that we just heard, for
that
instance.
That was a very proggy end to that song, actually. I was quite intrigued by the fact that they've thrown in a couple of modern numbers, as you say, that refer to more recent times in Cyprus and the financial crisis that the country's been going through.
There is a very striking track, which I think has already been played on Radio 3, which is the one with a guest vocalist, Maroula Constantinou, which I didn't choose because it's atypical, but it uses drum machine and it uses these very kind of rather strange and haunting vocals and generates a different kind of atmosphere. And that's perhaps a hint of what this band might be capable of as they develop and they get more popular.
The album sounded a bit like a work in progress to me, and there was enough there to keep me interested and think, actually, these are intriguing times, and, you know, they're not just reviving some of the heritage from Cyprus, but they're also commenting on modern situations that their generation is going through. But there was a bit of an identity crisis, and I think you've kind of picked up on that by pointing out the track that they've done with the drum machines, Young Upwardly Mobile Professional, I think it's called.
That's right.
doesn't quite sit with the more rootsy melodies.
Gripi Grappa by Monsieur Doumani from Cyprus is out now on their own label. Arwa was sort of staying vaguely in that part of the world, but moving a little further north. What have you brought?
Right, yes. The next compilation we're going to listen to is called Stand Up People, and it's a collection of gypsy pop songs from Tito's Yugoslavia, spanning 1964 to 1980. It was an era of autocratic rule, but also a time that actually afforded the Roma people their own recognised status. So it's a fascinating collection of very vivacious music, and as you'd imagine, there's a great diversity of roots and voices on here, but perhaps the most fiery voice on this collection is the celebrated queen of the gypsies, Esma Recepova. And the track we're going to listen to by her, there are several on this compilation, is called Apre Papi Sokerijan, and it's a track where she beseeches her father not to marry her off too young.
Get a job, to 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 get a
The Queen of the Gypsies, Esma Recepova, with her song Abre Babi Sokerjan. And that was recorded, when was that actually recorded?
1964, so it's one of the earlier tracks on that compilation.
Which, and the compilation, the title of the compilation is Stand Up People, Gypsy Pop Songs from Tito's Yugoslavia, 1964 to 1980. And that is out on Asphalt Tango, that label that's doing really wonderful compilations of early 1960s, 50s, 60s recordings.
There's a real passion about the way they put these things together. And
yeah,
they've found recordings from libraries and also just by hunting down collectors and going into shops and finding old, you know, little bits of vinyl from here and there. And I must say, I think this compilation is done with great flair, but you know, it's interesting on sort of academic levels, lots to read and contextualize, but it's also sequenced in a way that makes it a really strong listen.
And of course, what, as you were saying, Arwa, it's what's really interesting, and I suppose the title Stand Up People comes from that, is that that Tito, although a dictator, did give status to the Roma people, which is not the case so much anymore in that part of, you know, former Yugoslavia.
And what's musically exciting is that the Roma culture gave rise to a very weirdly hybrid music, because they absorbed so many different parts of the Balkan music and also Indian music, which you can hear in there and even more in some of the other tracks.
So. Absolutely. It's a really interesting mix of both heritage and some modern influences as well, because actually the sleeve notes on the album are fascinating, because there's so many different levels of... so many different stories here, so many... singers that maybe aren't as well known as Esma is. And
but yeah, she's got a great story too, doesn't she?
She really does.
They travelled to India and back over land, performing everywhere, including Iraq.
Yes, that's right. At one point, she and her band performed for Saddam Hussein. She's certainly one of the most well-travelled voices that I've listened to, and certainly on this album, she's probably the most well-travelled voice, and apparently, you know, studied lots of languages along the way as well. And I don't know whether I should mention this, but I was intrigued to... She's still very much alive and well, which is obviously great, and... sounds like she's still in very good voice, but I was intrigued to find out that she actually entered the Eurovision Song Contest for Macedonia this year and didn't qualify.
Really?
Yeah. So I would say remember her this way, because this is a great album. I think I was expecting it to be, like, when I first got the album as well, I mean, you know, the title suggests this collection of protest songs. In a sense, they are protest songs, but they're very personal protest songs and cries from the heart. And
yeah, it's embedded in the music,
yeah.
Rather than lyrics that in a language we don't understand. So I think that makes it a very exhilarating listen.
Well, that album, Stand Up People, Gypsy Pop Songs from Tito's Yugoslavia, 1964 to 1980, is out on Asphalt Tango. Well, we're moving on now to the last of the CDs that we're reviewing in today's World Roots. John, what is it?
This is an album called Alter from a singer called Ninka, who comes from Friesland. And most of the songs on the album are sung in the Frisian language, which is something I had no knowledge of until just a week or so ago. And there's a curious kind of Northern Europe, Southern Europe hybrid here, because Friesland is the northern part of the Netherlands, and she's working with a producer and musicians from Spain.
Javier Limón.
That's correct. And using palmas and kind of flamenco-style guitar and...
But not on all the tracks.
No, it's... I must say, I don't find this a completely satisfying album. I think there's a few quite interesting tracks and they're original compositions. The language itself gives a certain kind of... coolness.
Arwa?
My interest was definitely piqued by the notion of being able to hear songs in a language that was new to me, and the combination, as you say, of different traditions. But rather than sparking a kind of magical fusion, it just left me feeling really ambivalent, this collection, because the good things about Ninka's voice, I mean, she's got a very lucid, coolly poetic way of singing, but it kind of made for quite an anodyne collection, I thought. At its best, it has a poetry. At its worst, it felt insufferably polite to me and just lacked any kind of soul.
She does have a lovely voice, it must be said. I mean, she is, you know, she's got a kind of... There's something sort of slightly Joan Baez-y about her voice, without quite being as special as... Joan Baez.
Well, when I first heard her, I thought of Larsa, and then lo and behold, there is a cover of a song by Larsa, which is the final track on this album.